Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast that unpacks the latest in psychology and neuroscience research with expert special guests. I'm Ava.
And I'm Beth.
And this week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Sebastian Speer, who is currently a postdoc at the psychology department at Princeton University, but is also an incoming professor at Texas A&M University. In this episode, we talked a lot about his research on conversations between friends versus strangers and what really makes for a good conversation, both from the neural level and the linguistic level. And he also talks about how we can persuade people and come to agreements and what the difference between a persuasion frame of mind is and a compromise frame of mind.
I'm Sebastian. I'm currently a postdoc at the psychology department in Princeton. Here I'm working on conversations. So what we do specifically is that we hyperscan people while they're having real-time conversations. And then we look at how conversations between friends and strangers differ, which types of conversations lead to better conversation outcomes. That means which conversations have people report these conversations afterwards as being more enjoyable, them feeling closer to their conversation partner, or similar to their conversation partner. And we also look at what types of conversations help people find agreement with each other and which do not. So like how the conversation dynamics differ and what happens in the brain when people have these conversations. And can we learn something from the neural processes to tell us about what makes a better conversation?
You talked about the fact that you do hyperscanning, which is the main method that we'll talk about today. Could you actually share what that is? So what type of brain scanning method actually is that?
Hyperscanning essentially just means that you're scanning two or more people at the same time. And so you can do that with different methods. You can use fMRI, EEG, or fNIRS. Those are the most common ones. We do it with fMRI here because we're really lucky because we have two scanners in the basement here at Princeton in adjacent rooms, which makes that hyperscanning very feasible and possible. People have also done it in the past, actually across different sites. It's pretty impressive because it's quite a logistical challenge. I mean, even doing hyperscanning with two scanners in adjacent rooms is already a challenge, but this is basically what we do.
So we'll get into some of your work. We'll talk about a couple of papers today, but first, a really cool paper that you put out in 2024, looking at these differences that you mentioned in the intro of how friends kind of have conversations with each other and how strangers have conversations with each other. So could you first just kind of set up the study and what you actually had people do while they're lying there in the scanner?
So this was the first hyperscanning study that we ran, and we really just wanted to look at a very basic question, and that essentially boils down to what makes for a good conversation. And so we recruited two very different types of dyads for this study. So half the people were friends, so people with an already pre-existing social connection. And we had pretty strict criteria on what it means to be friends. So they had to be in contact for at least 3 days a week for the last half year. So they know each other fairly well. And then the other ones were complete strangers. So they were just starting to form a social connection. And then we wanted to look at what types of conversation lead to stronger social connection at the end of a conversation and higher ratings in enjoyability, closeness, and similarity. And the task that we used was adapted from the Fast Friends procedure, which is a procedure that was developed in the 90s by social psychologists. And the way that it works is very similar to, maybe you've heard of the 35 Questions to Fall in Love by the New York Times. So those are basically very similar questions or conversation prompts that we used. And they are really easy conversation starters, such as, if you could choose any person in the world to have dinner with, who would that be? The Fast Friends procedure works by making these conversation prompts more and more personal and intimate over time. In the beginning, you have something that I just mentioned, and then a later prompt would be something like, share an embarrassing moment from your life or share one of your greatest fears. The intimacy and how private the topics are get more and more over the course of the conversation.
So can you tell us kind of what you found in this study? So the differences between the friends and the strangers and what actually did make for a better conversation for both of them?
quite unsurprisingly, we found that friends have better conversations than strangers. They rate the conversations being more enjoyable, feeling closer to the conversation partner and feeling more similar. But then we wanted to see, okay, how do the conversations actually differ in terms of the neural dynamics, the topics that they talk about, the language that they use. And we use this method that allows us to decode people's mental states from their brains and from language. And what we found with that method is that friends' mental states align at the start of a conversation. So they start off with common ground, but then we see them diverging over the course of a conversation, basically exploring more different mental states and being in different locations, more and more different locations over time. Strangers, in contrast, start off more distant and then align over the course of a conversation. And so then we were wondering, okay, how does this happen? Like, what do the friends talk about? What do the strangers talk about? And in order to do that, we looked at topic modeling. And we found that friends basically talk about the initial prompt for a few seconds, and then they jump to different topics very quickly. And the topic jumps are sometimes really large. Strangers, in contrast, they talk about the given prompt for a longer time and really stick to the topic for longer. So the way we interpreted that is that essentially what happens is that friends have more exploratory conversations. They cover more topics, they jump between topics much more, and that leads them to cover more mental states and more topics in general. And strangers, because they don't know each other, stick to the topics for longer, and through that process, their mental states become more and more similar, so they build common ground over the course of a conversation.
So when you talk about one conversation in the context of this study, is it like one topic, so one question that they're given, so who would you want to have dinner with, or is it all of those questions combined?
So we look at each prompt as an individual conversation, and then we see this pattern arise over these different conversations. So okay. Like within each conversation, they tend to start, the friends start aligned and then they diverge. And for the friends, they start off more distant than they align.
Did you see any differences when you looked at kind of those deeper questions versus the more easy small talk type questions?
We haven't looked at that yet. So the only thing, the general trends that we see is that if you look over all the conversations, is that both friends and strangers tend to align slowly over the course of the entire conversation. So it seemed that could be partially driven by the fact that the prompts get more and more intimate, but we haven't actually tested exactly. So basically there are three different categories. There are very broad topics, intermediate ones, and then the very intimate ones. We could definitely run analysis to see how the patterns differ across these different categories, but we haven't done that yet.
Yeah, it seems like some people might also be more willing to talk to a stranger about these deep things than maybe some other people, maybe because of a personality thing or because they feel a connection with that stranger. But it seems like maybe some people would be uncomfortable discussing that with a stranger. I don't know if you were able to listen into what they were saying, but if they were ever, if you could hear people feeling kind of more awkward with strangers versus friends, or it could be vice versa. I know some people feel super comfortable discussing issues, like deeper issues, with strangers too.
That's a good point. That was also something I was worried about when I first heard about the design. When I started listening to the conversations, so we recorded all the audio and we have all the transcripts, it's quite remarkable to see how good people are at having these conversations. So there are hardly any awkward silences. People are really open about even private matters, even with strangers. So I can't remember listening to any conversation where people just outright refused to talk about it or didn't know what to say anymore. So like they always filled up the full 3 minutes without much trouble. I mean, that could also partially be because we recruited participants from the Princeton University campus. So they all have some common ground already. They all study in a small college town in New Jersey, you know, and they might know the same people or the same professors. And so it would probably be very different if you had people from very different demographic backgrounds or cultural backgrounds, which is definitely also an interesting future direction to explore. Also, myself being German, we are not that good at small talk. And so, like, I was particularly impressed by how well these undergrads were doing at having conversations with each other. I think if you would run the same study in Germany, it would be much more awkward for sure.
So one of the findings that I thought was really interesting was that strangers tend to find this common ground and friends explore more. But the strangers who behaved a little bit more like friends, so who actually did explore more, reported having better conversations. So do you think that that's because they felt that there was some kind of common ground from the beginning in some ways, like that click that people talk about, of kind of an instant feeling that you maybe do have something in common, so you're able to, you kind of have a secure base that you can go from? Because it seems like you shouldn't just, you know, be saying crazy random stuff to someone in a conversation with a stranger thinking that will go well.
Yeah, so indeed, the strangers that explored more, so that covered more topics, that diverged more in mental state space, were the ones who reported having better conversations, and their conversation trajectories looked a lot like the friends' trajectory. So they started off aligned, which seems to suggest that they somehow were able to click very quickly, to find common ground quickly, and then were able to diverge. We also have another study led by a previous postdoc from the lab, Haran Senat, and he used longer conversations that lasted for 30 minutes. It's the CANDOR dataset, which is, I think, quite well known in the conversation analysis field. And basically what he found is a quadratic effect. So in the CANDOR dataset, all the conversations are between strangers. And what he finds is that strangers start off more distant in this mental state space and then align over the course of a conversation until they hit a certain deflection point, and then they start exploring. So it essentially speaks to what you were describing. Strangers start out trying to find that common ground, and then once they hit that point and they feel safe enough, they start exploring and diverging and covering more topics and basically having more fun conversations, essentially. So we were really happy to see that there's this quadratic effect that kind of confirms what we found previously with the shorter conversations.
Okay, so you shouldn't be just saying random stuff to a stranger. You should try to find some common ground, maybe feel comfortable, and then you can, once you feel safe. But I don't know if you have advice on how to get there, because sometimes it just feels like it's there or it's not.
So two thoughts. One thing is that we were also thinking, so that goes back to that quadratic effect deflection idea, that you could basically determine how well you click by looking at that deflection point, right? Like if you hit that point, that common ground point earlier, you probably click better with that person because you found that common ground more easily. So it's kind of a nice indicator of how well you get along with someone in a conversation. How to get there is basically the million-dollar question. I have some anecdotal evidence or some intuitive ideas. I remember Danny Bassett's talk about curiosity, and she describes these different profiles of curiosity. And I remember one of them was sort of that you just jump around a lot, I think the butterfly or something. So like they used a Wikipedia data set and looked at how people were basically navigating through Wikipedia. And then the butterfly person was that they would just read a little bit on one topic and jump to a completely unrelated topic. The idea is that if you would use something like that at the beginning of a conversation, right, you just cast a wide net and try lots of different topics until you find something that actually clicks with the other person. That helps you to build common ground. So like you cast the wide net at the beginning, then you find a topic that you both like, and then you stick with that to build the common ground. And then once you have that, then you can start exploring. So maybe that works, but it's also kind of risky, right? Because just shooting random topics at another person might also go wrong.
We had another guest on who was also working on conversations, and one of the things they were looking at was the gaps in conversations, like how quickly people speak to each other. And I guess in this paradigm, you had to say when the next person was able to speak, so there was no interruptions, right, when people were talking?
Yeah, so that makes it slightly less naturalistic than conversations outside of the scanner. Indeed, the way it worked was that you have to press a button to end your turn and then pass the microphone to the other speaker. that was necessary for the logistics of hyperscanning because only one person's voice was recorded at a time. Indeed, that kind of made it easier for us to analyze the data, but that also removes some of the information inherent in real naturalistic conversations, such as indeed like the gaps between conversation, minimal encouragers, back channels, these sorts of things. We couldn't really capture those because we had that more structured turn-taking. Having said that, the conversation still flowed fairly quickly, naturally and rapidly.
One of the things that I found really interesting was that it seemed like the neural data was kind of a better predictor than the language data. Could you talk a little bit more about that and kind of what that means and how you're interpreting that?
So one explanation just comes down to the fact that when you look at language, you only get information from one person at a time, right? Like you can only measure what the speaker is saying because the listener isn't producing any words. And so you lose that side of the conversation. With the hyperscanning and the neural data, is you basically get output from both people continuously. So you can see how the listener reacts to what the speaker is saying in real time. So you basically have twice as much power, statistically speaking. Another reason is that, to some extent, language is constrained by our ability to verbalize what we're feeling or thinking, right? And so we might not always be able to capture exactly all the emotions that we're feeling when we're talking about something or all the thoughts that are going through our mind. With the neural data, in principle, you could get at all of that. I'm not saying that we're able to capture all of it at the moment, but as we refine our methods, we'll be able to have a more direct access to what people are feeling, which is not constrained by the filter of our ability to verbalize what we're thinking or feeling. And one last reason might be that it kind of relates to the second reason, is that the neural data is just much more high dimensional. So like you're collecting signal from 40,000 different voxels every 2 seconds, whereas with the language data, you get a word every few seconds, and then these words get projected into like word embeddings of like 300 dimensions, which are also a lot of dimensions. But I mean, the complexity that you can capture with 40,000 voxels at a sampling rate of 2 seconds is just much higher, statistically speaking, as compared to the words and the lower dimensional word embeddings. So I think to some extent it's statistical, and to some extent it's also just the filter of verbalizing the content of our mental states.
So I know there's some research looking at like language versus just the sounds that people are making. And yeah, I don't know if obviously you weren't able to capture video or anything here, but there's so much research now about synchrony in terms of the way that people are, their facial expressions or their posture. So do you think if you were able to kind of have that information that would be able to explain just as much or more than the neural data, or the neural data just because we have so many voxels all the time that it's really just like more of a statistical question? And I know this is like beyond the scope of your research, but it feels like your body language and all of those kind of ineffable things that happens during a conversation really inform how it feels to have that conversation. So I wonder what the brain is doing compared to those types of things that we can
see. I think they all contribute different chunks of variance that you can explain, right? So indeed, there's a lot going on outside just what we're saying, or even like what we're thinking and feeling, or like we're communicating it through a lot of different channels. So I just went to a workshop in Helsinki in Finland, where I visited a lab that was working a lot on nodding behavior and gaze patterns. They also showed that they can explain quite a lot of variance in the quality of conversations just based on the frequency of nods, the timing of nods, where people are looking, what they're attending to. So you can explain quite a lot of variance from these signals outside of what people might consider the core elements of a conversation. I think ideally you would be able to measure all of these signals at the same time and then try to combine them and see which parts of the variance each of these signals explains best. That would be really cool.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I feel like a lot of those types of things too feel very cultural, like the ways in which people might move their bodies kind of in response to what someone is saying. So I feel like, you know, maybe when you're having those also intercultural conversations, it might be harder to have a good conversation because of things like that, especially with explaining so much variance. That's really interesting.
Yeah, they were actually doing really cool research there. So Helsinki has, or Finland in general, has a minority of Swedish-speaking Finns that are culturally more similar to Swedes than to Finns, but they live in Finland. And so what they were doing is that they compared conversations between Finnish-speaking Finns and Swedish-speaking Finns and looked at essentially the cultural differences within these two groups of people. And so Swedish-speaking Finns have much more variance in their prosody. So like similar to Swedish, where it's like a lot, it's almost like singing a melody when they speak. And Finns are much more monotonous. And also in terms of emotional engagement, they just seem much more calm or more reduced in their emotional expression. And it was really interesting to see that play out. So they were giving people very easy topics to talk about, for instance, such as, are dogs better than cats? And then have them basically discuss that topic. And for the Finnish Finns, it was completely normal that they were so muted. But for the rest of the audience, they thought, do they not like each other? What's going on there? So you could really tell that there's big differences. And I feel like that would feel like a prediction error indeed. If you talk to somebody and they're very monotonous and you're not used to that from your own cultural background, that might seem like they're not engaged, but they might actually really be into the conversation they're currently having.
So one of the things that you also look at in this research is this idea of closeness versus similarity. I'm wondering if you could just kind of talk about that, because I think these kinds of questions kind of speak to that maybe in some cases, can you perceive someone as really different to you, but then you feel also really close, or do those things kind of tend to co-vary? Because also in the similarity idea, like in general, I feel like in synchrony, people kind of talk about similarity of your neural patterns is good, but then maybe in some situations, we actually do want them to diverge.
In terms of the outcomes, so like the self-report measures, we have closeness, similarity, and enjoyment. We derived them from a broader set of questions that we had, and then we did factor analysis and found that those three were sort of the latent dimensions that best explained the variance in answers to the questions. Those three different dimensions still correlate very highly. So more enjoyable conversations are usually also ones that make you feel closer and more similar to the conversation partner. So they were all still fairly highly correlated. So I don't think there are big differences between closeness and similarity. Something slightly related, I don't know if that's also what you were getting at, is that there is a lot of literature that is pointing to synchrony as the ingredient that leads to stronger social connection and all types of better conversation outcomes. So that is also something that we were grappling with because, yeah, we looked at the literature, we did literature review and saw that all these studies were pointing to synchrony as like the marker or indicator of a good conversation. And then we were surprised that we essentially find the opposite. It's like, what's going on? Like, how is this possible? Our explanation is that our experiment differs a bit in what previous studies have done. First of all, a lot of the previous studies have more one-directional types of naturalistic stimuli. So you have a lot of studies where people watch movies together or they listen to audio or a lecture or something, and then they analyze the data with intersubject correlations. And that is very different from having a bidirectional conversation where people actually talk to each other and can influence each other's experience as the conversation unfolds. And then second, there is a difference in the analytic approach. As I mentioned, like most previous studies used intersubject correlations where they correlate the time series of the average activity in a region over time, which gives you a relative measure of alignment or synchrony. And what we did is that we used a whole brain decoding approach that gives us an absolute readout of a person's location in what we call mental state space. So here you get the actual absolute difference in how far they're apart, in how they're feeling or what they're thinking about. And that allows us to really see like how far they are apart and how they are moving through the conversation, how they're moving through that space throughout the conversation. And so the experimental and the analytic differences might explain why we see different things that previous approaches couldn't quite get at because of the differences in experimental design and analysis.
Right. I mean, it makes sense because I remember going to some synchrony workshop as well where there was a lot of research in couples that synchrony was good, but then people were saying, well, if you're having a disagreement with your partner, and then you're both getting very heated at the same time to the same degree, then that's really not a good thing. So it doesn't make sense that we would want to be in sync all the time. And same with a conversation partner. If you're talking to someone who's just like you and saying exactly what you think, then it's not very interesting.
Exactly. So, if all the conversation partner did was to repeat back to you what you just said, then it would just get boring and very predictable.
So I loved listening to this, Ava, because I love conversations. Number one, I was thinking I love chatting. I love a chat. I love chatting to all sorts of people about all sorts of things. But one of the things I was thinking about, and Sebastian also alluded to this as well, is how different this would be in different countries. I think, you know, lots of research we talk about, oh, this will be different cross-culturally, but conversation, 100% so different. And Australians, lots of people who don't like small talk struggle with Australians because we love small talk. I think it serves a really nice purpose of a sort of easeful communication. But as Sebastian said, perhaps Germans not so much. In Australia, we always say, hi, how are you going? And some of my German friends have said they feel that that's superficial because we don't really want to know how someone's going. We just want to someone to say like, yeah, I'm good, how are you?
Okay, so I was talking to someone else about this like small talk versus deep talk distinction. Mm-hmm. And what do you actually think the distinction is? Because also in the paradigm that they use, the fast friends paradigm, Sebastian mentioned that they go from more kind of surface level things to deeper conversations that are, I suppose, in some ways more intimate. But yeah, what do you think like counts as small talk versus not small talk also?
Small talk, I would say, would be things about weather, what you're
Classic.
Getting from the shops.
Mm.
Like, oh, I'm just going to go to the shops. We like talking about that a lot here.
Do you think it's things that are in some ways a bit ephemeral and they won't have an impact on your life, really?
Yeah.
Longer term?
I think that that's a really beautiful definition.
I hope I have it. I'm sure there's lots of literature about this because I know that there's research about having a good conversation and making it not be small talk. And I've heard people say, like, let's just get rid of small talk. And I'm like, no. Because I think one of the things that Sebastian's research kind of shows is that you can't just go into it. I understand the idea of wanting the conversation to diverge and people to explore as a dyad, but also maybe on your own semantic space. But you can't do that without the safety of knowing that you have some base level of understanding. So I feel like if you automatically just go super deep with someone, that's like very alarming. And I feel like when that's happened to me or someone just shares very suddenly, I'm open to receiving it. I think we, Beth and I, are both people that invite that type of communication when people talk to us, but I feel taken aback and it makes me feel hesitant about the relationship if I don't really know someone and they're immediately like, this is my deepest secret. I'm like, oh, okay.
I agree. And I think a good example is, so say you're at the supermarket and someone is checking your things out. You want to talk to them. It's really rude not to. But you, in that moment, you can't ask about, you know, what's going on with their relationship with, I don't know, their parents. Like, that's not appropriate at that time. At that time, it's appropriate to be like, how are you going? Yeah, I'm good. How are you going? Yeah, I'm good. Oh, what a good deal on these apples today. Yeah, it's such a good deal. People are really excited about it. And then move on.
Yeah, I think that question of appropriateness is actually really interesting. And it speaks to a kind of fluidity of knowing when you should, like a competence of how to approach these conversations. But I will say that I feel like, you know, in the age of loneliness that we're in, I kind of feel like maybe some people are super open to having deeper conversations because I don't think I told you about my train experience when I was going to the south of Spain. I mean, I'm not going to get into it, but basically this man told me his entire life story and it was very intense.
Oh no.
And he basically said, like, I haven't spoken to anyone deeply in the last 5 years or something.
That's so smart.
And I just feel like more people than we think might be walking around with that type of thing. But in that conversation, I was like, this is a 3-hour train, which ladies don't do that because it didn't end the best. But I was like, this is a 3-hour train. He's already talking to me. So I literally just asked a couple questions and he was like, the floodgates opened and he clearly hadn't been talking to anyone for a long time. And I think that more people than we know might feel like this and feel like they're missing these connections. So I don't know if we are just in a time where people don't have those types of channels. But I do think at the same time, I don't know what that does to like the dyad relationship, because I think maybe if someone has just told you their entire life story, maybe the person on the receiving end feels uncomfortable and is like, I don't think I want to continue this relationship. But also maybe the person who's shared that much is like, whoa, I don't think. Yes. And I don't know if you're really connecting with the other person if it's kind of one-sided.
Yeah, I think if you're really connecting with one person, it's not one-sided, it's different.
Yeah, that it has to be reciprocal. Like you have to travel the space together.
Yeah, I really think so. But I also think with those reflections, then I think it just speaks more to why we need small talk, because we can't just have that, what you described. That would be insane. That's what I don't get when people don't like small talk. What do they want? What, like just everything should be super intense?
Yeah, I agree. I had a kind of a group conversation because a researcher came to give a talk here and she was like, let's do away with small talk. And a lot of us were like, no. And she was like, I don't have time. Like, I don't have the time to be doing small talk. Life is short. And then one other grad student was like, I lived in Germany and in Germany, they don't engage in any type of small talk, but it's not replaced by having interactions that are also very deep with people you don't know. It's just everyone ignores each other.
Yeah.
So I do feel like you need it like a social lubricant to get to the next phase.
Yeah,
like to get to the divergence, you kind of need to set up something safe-ish. Yeah.
So I think we need to be less critical of small talk and more accepting of it.
Okay, that's my question. Okay, well, speaking of deep talk and small talk, I thought we should actually look at some of the prompts, just so if people are interested, you want to have a really intimate conversation with a friend, but you want to warm up. In Sebastian's study, they ask participants questions and then they take turns to answer the questions, and they go from relatively more small talky, I think they're more medium talky, to much deeper. I'll give you the first 3 questions so people hear them, and then you can choose one to answer, okay? Okay, the first question is, given the choice of anyone in the world, whom would you want as a dinner guest? Okay, that's the first one. Second one is, would you like to be famous? In what way? And then the third one is, before making a phone call, do you ever rehearse what you're going to say and why?
Wait, are these medium talk? This to me is already a
deep.
Lot. Yeah, I feel that I'm already struggling. Okay, I'm not going to overthink it. Dinner guest, Bruce Springsteen, because I just watched the movie and I love him.
Oh. Turn ended. Okay. I have no idea what I would answer for the first one. I'm skipping it. Okay, would I like to be famous? In what way? I'll do that one.
Okay.
I think my parents, yeah, look, it's deep. But maybe that's like an interesting thing you could look at in the content is like, how deep do people get with the very first one? What I was going to say was, I think my parents really instilled in me from a young age, especially my dad, that it was really horrible to be famous. Every time we'd see a famous person, he'd be like, imagine that. It's just a terrible life. And I really feel like that because sometimes we talk about, you know, famous people or whatever. And I always feel really sorry for them. Like, I feel really sorry for the Kardashians. Because
I do feel sorry for the Kardashians.
We've talked about that,
yeah,
right?
I'm always confused by that.
I don't know. I just feel like it's such a curse.
Yeah.
And I mean, we had our 2 seconds of the smallest amount of fame, which was something going semi-viral on TikTok. And I hated every second of that. Also because people were being kind of mean to us. But
what?
I feel like you were like, it was great. They loved it. And I was like, yeah, they're mean. I feel like I interpret everything negatively. Any small negative feedback, I remember that. So I don't think I would be good at being famous. I would like people in the field to know my work, but that's it. And I would like our podcast to be successful, but that's it. Okay, do you want to go to the last ones?
Yeah.
I feel like this one's fine. Okay, these are the last three. What, if anything, is too serious to be joked about?
Oh.
That's a toughie. The next one is, your house containing everything you own catches fire. After saving your loved ones and pets, you have time to safely make one final dash to save one item. What would it be and why? Okay, the last one is, share a personal problem and ask your partner, so Beth or Ava in this case, your partner's advice on how they might handle it. Also ask your partner to reflect back to you how you seem to be feeling about the problem you've chosen.
I feel like if these are the last ones and those other ones are the first ones, I'm not saying, like, these are all, these are all intense. Okay, I'm gonna, the house burning down. I think I would say my mom got me this really beautiful necklace when I graduated from my PhD. And it's very, very special to me. So I think I would say that.
Wow, you're doing really good, concise answers.
Because I don't feel super attached. I don't know. I feel like when you, I feel like if my loved ones and pets are okay, I'm okay, you know?
Mm. Deep. I do think the last one is interesting because it's so dyadic in nature in the sense that it invites the other person to engage back to you.
Yeah, I like that. I just couldn't think of a problem that I have going on right now. Otherwise, I would have done that one.
Beth is doing really well, guys. Can you tell? We'll switch gears now from talking about friends and just light conversations to talking about persuading people. In this study, you look at this really interesting question of persuasion versus compromise, so how we get people to actually try to change their minds and come to this common ground that you looked at more naturalistically in that first study. So could you talk about what you had people discuss and then what the conditions were as well?
Yeah, it was again an fMRI hyperscanning study, and this time we only recruited strangers. Indeed, the goal wasn't for them to form a social connection, but to find agreement with each other. And in order to stimulate debates, we gave participants controversial topics. We chose the cost of tuition and air pollution as two of the topics. We determined those via piloting in terms of which topics create the most disagreement, essentially, so that there's enough to talk about for them. People would get some information about the topics, and then they would listen to a news podcast that fairly neutrally describes the consequences related to these topics. And then afterwards, they would discuss the topics for 10 minutes with a stranger. In order to measure agreement, we gave them five different solutions or policy solutions that could address these issues. And then we asked them to allocate $100 million in funding across these five different solutions. And they would allocate the money before the conversation and after the conversation. So then we could see basically how their opinions changed in terms of how the money allocation differed from before to after the conversation. And we could also see how their opinions aligned or diverged after the conversation. So whether their opinions in terms of the allocation of money got more similar after the conversation or more different to what it was before. Then we also had two different experimental conditions. In one of the conditions, participants were asked to persuade their conversation partner. So both of the partners were asked to persuade the other one. And in the other condition, they were asked to find a compromise with the conversation partner. So we found that people that were instructed to compromise, as you might expect, actually ended up finding more agreement, significantly more agreement than participants that were assigned to persuade each other. And that is not particularly surprising. That is also what the previous communication literature suggests. So it's actually good that we found that, because otherwise, I guess something would have gone wrong. The more interesting question was, how do conversations in the compromise condition differ from conversations in the persuade condition? And that's what we looked at again with this mental state decoding approach. We again found that more exploratory conversations lead to better conversation outcomes. In this case, people finding more agreement. And we find that people that are instructed to compromise are the ones who engage in more exploratory conversations. So essentially what we find is a mediation effect where the instructions to compromise increases exploration in conversation, and that exploration then leads to more agreement.
In these conversations that people were having, because there were kind of like basically five buckets of solutions that they could choose, did it ever happen that over the course of the conversations they decided, rather than, let's say someone said, let's put all our money in bucket one, and someone said, let's put all our money in bucket set five, that they kind of decided, oh, let's put money in actually this whole separate type of thing? Or was it just typically, we'll split the difference? Like, what were the approaches to compromise in the end?
So we haven't really systematically looked at different types of solutions, but generally in the compromise condition, also from looking at transcripts, what people were doing is that they were trying to, you know, find solutions that work for both of them. So they spent some time of the conversation at the end coordinating how they should arrange the allocation so that both of them are happy in the compromise condition. Whereas in the persuade condition, they had a specific profile in mind and then both tried to stick with it and try the other person to get closer to it. We haven't exactly found the right way to quantify basically what you're asking. But one way we were thinking of it is to look at entropy. So if a participant assigns all the money to one solution and none of the money to others, it has very low entropy. But when the allocation is spread across all five options, then it would have much, much higher entropy. And so we could look at how the changes in entropy differ between the compromise and the persuade condition. I think that would kind of get at what you're asking, like these different types of solution profiles.
I think it'd be interesting also to see if it were more, in some ways, creative problems, if there were ways that they're like thinking outside the box more when people are told to compromise and explore versus persuade each other.
Yeah, so we again use topic modeling. And so one way at getting at the creativity part might be to think about the number of topics that they discussed, right? And so we see that people in the compromise condition generate much more topics. So they, within the 10-minute conversation, they talk about much more different topics, which might suggest that they think of more different solutions, or at the very least, they discuss all of the five policy solutions. Whereas in the persuade condition, they might just pick one each and then like stick with that one. And that is also why the literature generally suggests that these instructions to compromise generate this sort of focus on mutual gains, which then helps the conversation partners to build in on each other's ideas and come up with more creative solutions. And that's essentially what we see in the topic modeling results as well. So not only do they generate more topics, but also the topics that they generate are more semantically distant from each other, which again kind of speaks to the creativity, right? Like, so they cover more just content space in general when they're talking about the solutions.
Yeah, I guess, were you expecting that? Because I found it intuitive in some ways that there's more exploration in these contexts. But then I also think if I hadn't have read the paper, if someone had asked me, I might have thought that when people are compromising, they might still kind of like reduce on the space that they're talking about because you're just trying to like find that common ground and move towards similarity. Were you expecting that exploration element?
Yeah, it's the similar surprise that we also had with the previous study where we would have thought that more connection is associated with more synchrony. So the way that we think of it now is from like a temporal angle. It seems like synchrony is kind of the end point or the start point, or it's like a marker of once you've reached the eventual outcome. But exploration is the way to get there. So exploration might be the process, where synchrony is kind of more like an indicator of the outcome. And so what we see is that in a compromise condition, people start off more mentally aligned. So through that instruction to compromise, they might start off in a more like common ground state of mind or might find each other more aligned already and then are able to start off exploring. Whereas in the persuade condition, like you said, they start with more entrenched positions. They don't really see eye to eye, which prevents them from engaging in exploration and then prevents them from finding a consensus eventually.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the obvious question here, which is that in these conversations that you had them do, maybe they had kind of strong opinions to go into it, but they're not the types of opinions that, you know, are dividing the nation and the world right now. And it feels like in this, the kind of takeaway from the study is explore more, be more open. But with those kind of more entrenched issues, it seems like people start off in that persuade frame of mind and then they can't actually potentially even open themselves to exploration. So do you think like that is kind of the issue here with those entrenched things, or are there ways that we can be like, be open? I don't know. So what are your thoughts, I guess, on, yeah, on the obvious question of, well, what happens when people do have these conversations of trying to find common ground that are issues that are more kind of near and dear to their heart?
I mean, that is an obvious question, but also a very exciting one, I think. So we wrote several grants on this, and we're actually currently running data collection for a new project that gets at exactly that question. So initially, we were indeed thinking along the lines of more political polarization, but in the current political climate, we thought that might be too risky. So we decided to focus on romantic couples, because there are obviously conflicts in romantic relationships, and they tend to be very emotional and intense and high stakes. In the previous study, the agreement study, people were giving hypothetical conversations that might get people emotional, but there aren't really any direct consequences for the conversation partners. Whereas in a romantic relationship, the outcome of an argument are very consequential and there are immediate and high stakes involved. There's also a large literature on romantic relationships. Based on that, we developed a new study in which we let couples come to the lab. And before they come to the lab, they rank common conflict topics. Both of them rank these topics. And then we choose two topics that they both rank very highly and let them discuss these topics for 10 minutes. We can use hyperscanning and look at how the conversations develop and which conversation dynamics essentially lead to better outcomes in the short term and in the long term. And yeah, we don't have any data yet. I'm very curious to see how that develops. Essentially, I think there are two ways this could go. Either we see that exploration prevails and more exploratory conversations lead to better outcomes. There's some literature to suggest that might actually be the case. So, I mean, there's a lot of negotiation literature in behavioral economics where they use these ultimatum games and dictator games and these sorts of behavioral decision theoretic games. And what they show there is as the stakes increase, cooperation levels seem to remain the same and the strategies that people use tend to be the same. I don't know if we can extrapolate to actual conversations and arguments between couples, but at least there's some evidence to suggest that similar mechanisms may be at play. On the other hand, it could also just be that it's a completely different thing and a completely different set of mechanisms at play. And that could be, as you said, because people have more intense emotions, right? Like they get angry, they get anxious, they get sad. And these sorts of emotions then elicit adversarial tactics. I don't know, like reduced perspective taking, deception, gaslighting, these sorts of things that then further increase the negative emotions and create this vicious cycle, which could then prevent them from actually being able to engage in exploration and more solution-focused strategies. So it will be really interesting to see which direction it goes. And yeah, we're curious.
Yeah, I guess you probably have data about the general quality of the relationship or what they kind of think about the relationship. But from what I understand, a lot of the research in close relationships, when they try to get their partners to talk about each other, talk about conflicts, it's kind of hard because it kind of depends on the quality of the relationship to begin with. So when people are in a good relationship, they just assume the best out of their partner. And when they're in a bad relationship, then they kind of make those dispositional attributions and stuff. So maybe those relationships that are already in a tough place, those can be good proxies for difficult conversations in politics, I wonder if you'll see big differences in terms of that base relationship quality when conflict comes up.
Yeah, so that's also something I've been thinking about. To some extent, I think people that would sign up for a study to come to a lab to do this sort of hyperscaling study in romantic relationships are probably not the ones that are just about to break up, right? So like there might be some selection bias here, but I'm sure there'll still be enough variance in relationship quality. I mean, there will be better and worse ones, maybe not the most extreme ones, but from talking to previous people who did relationship research, they said that these conversations can get very heated and sometimes even to the extent that the experimenter had to interfere because the conversations get so out of hand. We hope that that won't be the case, but that is to say that it seems like people really do get into the conversations and we might be able to capture really authentic sort of conflictual arguments.
Well, that will be very cool. I'm excited to see that come out. And what's on the horizon? So we have this couple study on the horizon, but you have kind of a very exciting announcement to make. You introduced yourself as a postdoc, but you're headed other places. So maybe you can tell us about that and about what your plans are for your lab.
So indeed, I'm starting my own lab next fall at Texas A&M University. It'll be called the Coupled Minds Lab, and we'll focus again on naturalistic conversations. One direction I want to take this is indeed on conflict resolution. So using this couple study, potentially also eventually looking at political polarization and just trying to figure out how these conversations differ from lower stakes and affiliative conversations, looking at which types of dynamics lead to more agreement and more conflict resolution. Another direction that I want to take is to look at conversations between humans and artificial minds, essentially looking at how these conversations differ in terms of their social content, their informational content, and to see if we can maybe also see patterns of alignment or exploration when we have conversations with LLMs and artificial intelligence.
Thank you to Dr. Sebastian Speer for joining us this episode.
Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madisouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.